Good evening. Trump meets protesters at the Veterans Day parade in New York. An anti-war protester speaks out, and a coup in Ecuador. Was the U.S. involved? With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the news from Monday, November 11th, 2019. President Donald Trump faced chance of lock him up, and anti-Trump banners hung from apartment windows as he was not so warmly welcomed for Veterans Day ceremonies in New York City. Trump, who recently gave up his New York residency for Florida, was speaking at the start of the annual Veterans Day parade, where it kicks off on Fifth Avenue near Madison Square Park. Speaking behind bulletproof plexiglass, Trump tried his best to drown out a throng of protesters shouting and blowing whistles outside the park's west entrance.
It is very fitting that the Veterans Day parade begin right here in New York City. Since the earliest days of our nation, New York has exemplified the American spirit and has been at the heart of our nation's story of daring and defiance. On July 2, 1776, the British Armada sailed into New York Harbor, numbering more than 400 ships and carrying more than 30,000 men. The British came here to snuff out.
Anti-Trump New Yorkers had also plastered windows overlooking the park with makeshift banners spelling out impeach, convict, and dump Trump. Trump became the first president to ever initiate New York City's famed Veterans Day parade, which marks its 100th anniversary this year. Some 25,000 people, including veterans, active duty members of the armed forces, and others, marched a 1.2-mile stretch along Fifth Avenue after Trump's remarks. Trump did not participate in the parade and was instead taken by car to his namesake skyscraper in Midtown after the speech. Medea Benjamin is founder of the anti-war group Code Pink. She says American militarism is not something to celebrate.
I think it's terrible that we continue to be in these wars 20 years after the 9/11 attacks, that Bush talks about, Trump talks about getting us out of the crazy endless wars and then keeps us in, and has increased the number of troops in the Middle East by 14,000 since he's been in the office. Talked about getting troops out of Syria, but instead they're now guarding the oil. And also, he sent 2,000 more troops into Saudi Arabia, where people feel that it is the Saudis, that it defiles the Holy Lands by having U.S. troops there. And I think it's been through Democratic and Republican administrations, we haven't been able to extricate ourselves from these wars. So this should be a day where we, yes, pay tribute to those who served, but we really try to talk about accountability for those who get us into these wars that are so hard to get out of. And we start reflecting on how we can build a foreign policy that is one that rejects intervention in other countries' internal affairs.
It's been, over as long as I can remember, a mantra of the right that somehow peace activists, progressives are disrespectful of the soldiers. You know, these untrue stories, but were told and became part of what the public believes, that peace activists spit on soldiers when they came back from Vietnam. We call them baby killers, all these kind of things. It's fed into it. On this, what is the real position of peace activists in America towards their military, and how does that differ from regular people?
There is a general sense that we have to separate the soldiers from the people who send them into wars, that we can be very critical of the latter while respecting the former. But it also means that there's not undue respect for the soldiers. I don't think that we should be thanking people for their service in the military and not thanking people for their service in being teachers or being nurses and doctors or being peace activists or environmentalists. There's many different kinds of jobs that people do to make our society better, and we should recognize those other kinds of contributions, especially on a day like Veterans Day, the contributions of people who are trying to stop wars. And that can include veterans, and there are many veterans groups and individual veterans who are doing that. And it includes people who never went to war and found ways around going to war because they had a conscientious objection to making war.
Is there, in your mind, a just war or a justifiable war? Is there any difference?
I don't think that we can call wars just wars. I think any war is a catastrophic mistake and a a blight on the human civilization that we weren't able to find a way to solve our differences without wars. If there needs to be any kind of intervention, it should be through the United Nations, through international bodies, not individual countries like the United States deciding where it should go and what countries it should invade. I think the time for that is long gone. But we do have to be careful that while there might be fewer examples of the U.S. intervening in other countries' affairs as we go forward, it doesn't mean we're not intervening in other ways. And the economic sanctions that the Trump administration has been imposing on countries like Venezuela, Iran, Cuba, these are really devastating. And just like in the lead up to the Iraq war, the Iraq sanctions killed hundreds of thousands of people. These sanctions today are killing people as well. So it's not just military intervention. It's also economic intervention that we have to stop.
Any projects you're working on now?
We've been trying to stop the U.S. from selling weapons to Saudi Arabia and being involved in the Saudi-led war in Yemen that is so catastrophic. We have come close by getting both houses in Congress to vote against it, but it keeps getting vetoed by the Trump administration. So we have to put more pressure to stop the U.S. involvement in this very, very horrendous, cruel war in Yemen.
And Medea Benjamin is founder of the anti-war group Code Pink. New York Mayor Bill de Blasio was in the audience, and Trump made a conciliatory gesture to the Democratic mayor, with who Trump is often at odds. Later, de Blasio was seen shaking hands with Eric Trump, the president's son. Look, it's the 100th anniversary of this parade, so I think it's very appropriate that the president was here. This is not a day for partisanship, de Blasio told reporters while taking a break along the Fifth Avenue parade route. Meanwhile, also on Monday, a federal judge dismissed New York's attorney general and state commissioner as defendants in Trump's lawsuit seeking to block a House of Representatives committee from obtaining his New York state tax returns. New York passed a law earlier this year that would allow the congressional committees to access Trump's state tax returns. Trump's lawyers filed a lawsuit in July, arguing that the New York law violates his free speech rights. The lawsuit is just one of several court fights over access to Trump's tax returns. Last week, an appeals court in New York ruled that Trump's longtime accounting firm must hand over 8 years of his tax returns to New York prosecutors. Trump's lawyers have said they will take that case to the U.S. Supreme Court. And you're listening to news on WBAI, listener-sponsored, independent and local news in New York. I'm Paul D'Arienzo. In international news, Hong Kong police shot and critically wounded a protester, and a man was set on fire on Monday in violence that prompted leader Carrie Lam to denounce demonstrators as enemies of the people. Protesters threw petrol bombs at police after a weekend of clashes across the Chinese-ruled territory, marking a dramatic escalation in more than 5 months of often violent pro-democracy unrest. There was also warnings of Chinese military intervention to quell the unrest. China has a garrison of up to 12,000 troops in Hong Kong who have kept to barracks throughout the unrest, but the nation has vowed to crush any attempts at independence. And Mexico says it's made arrests over last week's massacre of 3 women and 6 children of dual U.S.-Mexican nationality in the north of the country. The women and children from families of U.S. Mormon origin who settled in Mexico decades ago were killed last Monday on a remote dirt road in the state of Sonora by suspected drug cartel gunmen. Mexico's government has said it believes the victims were caught in a territorial dispute between rival drug cartels. On Sunday, Mexico said it had asked the FBI to participate in the investigation into the killings. And unrest convulsed Bolivia on Monday after President Evo Morales' resignation in the wake of disputed elections. Thousands of pro-Morales protesters are marching toward the nation's legislative assembly, setting the scene for a potential showdown with opposition and police. Police officers were loading live ammunition, one officer said, while others told reporters they were expecting a serious confrontation. The departure of Morales, which he has called a military coup, followed weeks of violent protests about allegations of election fraud. But Guillermo Long, a senior policy analyst with the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C., and a former member of the government of Ecuador, says there was no fraud, but an intervention by opponents of Morales' progressive policies.
There's no doubt about the fact that this is a coup, and it's actually quite a traditional sort of military textbook coup. I find it surprising that a lot of media, not wanting to call it like that. They're sort of really trying to go around the term coup. They're using the word transition, sort of treating it as a normal resignation. President Morales resigned because the military just stopped supporting him, and he was facing a police mutiny, and there was a lot of violence, and so therefore he didn't have the tools that he needed in order to be able to govern. So he resigned, but I think that the announcement on behalf of the high command of the military is very clear. They withdrew their support, which is their constitutional obligation, from the legitimate constitutional president, the president who still had been elected and had not finished his term. So I think it's a very clear coup, and I think it's also scandalous given the fact that President Morales bent over backwards to try and please everyone.
What about his policies that annoyed the military so much?
Progressive governments in Latin America have always been fighting in a non-level playing field, and they have the powers that be, the elites, particularly often the big corporate media, sometimes certain sectors of the military, but also foreign powers, have been waiting for the first opportunity to pounce, and this was one of them. There was an election in which Mr. Morales ran. There was some criticism prior to this election on behalf of the opposition, principally as to whether he should run or not. The ongoing legal battle inside Bolivia as to whether he should run for re-election. Eventually, the Constitutional Court allowed Mr. Morales to run for re-election. So there was undoubtedly a polarized context around the issue of re-election. But on the election day itself, he polled 47% in the first round, right, which is pretty high. Now, the OAS's new audit is saying that maybe it wasn't 47%, maybe it was slightly less. But even if it is a few thousand vote less, the OAS doesn't actually say how much he got in the end. It's a very nebulous report. It's still up in the high 40s, and he's still in first place, way in front of his contender. And the issue was whether there was to be a runoff or whether there was not to be a runoff, and whether Morales had won the election in the first round. So there was never really any issue of who came in first. To treat Morales, as some of the media have been treated him, as this unpopular character who's finally been toppled by the people sort of getting rid of a tyranny, which is some of the narrative that we're seeing in some of the press, I think is somewhat warped and not very objective.
Popularity, you know, in the end, popularity is really about, or could be construed in the Western Hemisphere to be about, popularity with the United States and popularity with whoever is the United States president. Is there the hand of the United States in this?
The hand of the United States certainly lingers in Latin America frequently. These kinds of events, we find out when we read history books years later that the United States was heavily involved. We'll have to see in this case what exactly the role of the United States was. I don't like to make accusations when I don't have exact proof, but I know I was myself a former government official in a progressive government that sometimes questioned the United States, its role in the world and its foreign policy. I know how hard it is. I know what it's like. The United States were always opposed to Evo Morales' government. Neither country has shared, haven't exchanged ambassadors since 2009, when the United States was accused by the Morales government of supporting an uprising against the Morales government, and in fact a regionalist, almost separatist uprising against the Morales government. So that meant that the Morales government expelled the U.S. ambassador at the time. This is back in 2009. And since then, both countries have had diplomatic relations, but they have not exchanged ambassadors. So relations were extremely tense, been downgraded. The United States and Bolivia were not on good terms. Sure, I mean, I would be very surprised if the United States wasn't behind this. In fact, the United States backed the OAS's sort of questioning of the elections from day one, and even more aggressive language than the OAS, and certainly more aggressive than any other Latin American country. So the United States, has been hostile to the Morales administration, I would say, throughout its mandate, and certainly during this political crisis.
What was he doing as far as his policies within Bolivia? And did this have something to do with his position on coca and on drugs in general, decriminalizing and legalizing them?
I don't think it has anything to do with coca. I think it has to do with what the left in Latin America did during the first decade and a half of this century. Sovereign national security doctrine with independent foreign policy, moving away from backyard, you know, heritage of Latin American countries, always accepting the U.S. line and taking orders from the United States. Clearly, there was an important period in Latin American recent history, particularly the first decade and a half of the 21st century, where a number of Latin American governments challenged U.S. hegemony in the region, and this was not taken well by the Washington establishment and the foreign policy establishment. And there have been a series of retaliation in the region. Bolivia is not the most powerful country in South America, and so maybe it hasn't been number one on the U.S. list of its South American leftist targets. There have been more important ones, but certainly Bolivia, it was on the U.S.'s agenda.
I mean, what's going to happen next?
We're extremely worried for the physical integrity, the security of former President Evo Morales himself and his vice president, Alvaro Garcia Linera, members of his cabinet. I've been in close contact to a number of people in Bolivia saying that, you know, it's out of control, the violence, the intimidation, people have been kidnapped, the houses have been burned down. Evo Morales' house has been attacked, his sister's house, lots of people fleeing the country, people hiding in the Mexican embassy. I have to say, the role of Mexico has been crucial in Latin America at the moment. Its embassies, in several countries, in Ecuador and in Bolivia now, are full of political refugees fleeing repression. It's important that the international community, Mexicans have asked for an OAS meeting, an urgent OAS meeting. It's important the international community calls for end of violence, the return to rule of law.
Guillermo Long is a senior policy analyst with the Center for Economic and Policy Research in Washington, D.C. He's held cabinet-level positions in the government of former Ecuadorian President Rafael Correa's government. And in national news, Little Rock teachers will go on strike for one day this week over an Arkansas panel's decision to strip their collective bargaining power and complaints about state control of the 23,000 student district. Union officials said that on Monday. The strike that will take place Thursday will be only the second time teachers have walked out of the job in Little Rock history. The Little Rock Education Association's announcement comes after the State Board of Education in October voted to no longer recognize the union when the contract expires on October 31st. The union has been calling for the state to give them back their bargaining power. Before the contract ended, the Little Rock School District had been the only one in Arkansas where a teachers union had collective bargaining power. But union leaders said Thursday's strike was focused more broadly on returning full local control to the district. Arkansas has run Little Rock schools since the state board took over the district in January 2015 because of low test scores at several schools. The state board has voted to put the district under a local board that will be elected in November 2020, but with limits on its authority. The strike will occur the day the state panel is expected to vote on establishing the zones for the new local school board. And just to make a short editorial aside, doesn't that sound familiar? And in local news, opponents of a massive flood control plan necessitated by sea level rise associated with global climate change that would close a beloved shoreline park in Manhattan's Lower East Side are gearing up for a series of crucial government meetings that will decide the fate of East River Park. On Tuesday, the City Council's Land Use Committee will decide the issue before sending it to the full council on Thursday for a final vote. The park reconstruction is expected to pass since it has the support of local council person Carlina Rivera. But opponents say the construction will deprive the neighborhood of vital open space and is counter to best practices for modern flood control projects. Pat Arno is founder of East River Park Action. She's calling on residents to come to the city council tomorrow and Thursday.
Tuesday, November 12th at 11 a.m., the Land Use Committee of the City Council will be voting on whether to approve the East Side Coastal Resiliency Project, and that's the project that will bury East River Park.
How important is that vote? Why is that vote being held now?
When the Land Use Committee votes, it will then be advanced to the full City Council, and then when the City Council votes, and if the plan is approved, then construction is due to start next year.
When is the full city council going to vote if it passes the committee?
The full city council will vote on Thursday at 1:30 at their regular meeting. We're going to have a press conference just before that at 1 o'clock on the steps of City Hall. City Council members Margaret Chin, Carlina Rivera, and Keith Powers the park is in their district, they have indicated they will vote for the flood control plan. The rest of the city council will not defy them. That's the tradition in city council. If the project is in your district, then you go along with what the city council member wants. The main city council person here is Carlina Rivera. Almost all of the park is in her district.
Are you disappointed with her intention to vote for this project?
Oh, yes, yes, yes. We've been trying to talk her into voting no or getting really important modifications for months and for really a year. And we feel like she's really let us down.
This has been divisive in the neighborhood. Some folks in favor of this project, others like yourselves against it. What's at the root of that?
I think most of the people in the neighborhood are against it. We understand that we've been described as a neighborhood that's divided, but that's not really true. Most of the neighborhood is very against this plan. When they find out about it, we meet people in the park and they start crying. People do not want to lose their park. They know that there's a better way to get flood control for this neighborhood that doesn't involve killing the park where so many people grew up and spend so much time. The only place in this neighborhood to get real fresh air and places to exercise and walk and sit and get shade in the summertime and barbecues. The place is jam-packed. It's not a tourist park. It's a real park, and the people who go to it are low-income people. That's why one reason we think that we're being so disregarded and so disrespected.
Weren't there changes, though? Weren't changes made?
Yes. Recently, the mayor announced that the park would be closed in phases. So 42% of the park will remain open at all times. We are not happy with this because phased destruction of this park is still, phased construction is still phased destruction. It's still going to kill the whole park. It's still going to kill 1,000 trees. It's still going to kill a running track that just got refurbished for $3.5 million and that people use constantly. It's going to kill the promenade that $66 or $67 million to refurbish and was finished in 2011.
What happens next as far as your group after the vote?
We'll keep fighting. We'll keep trying to get a better plan for our park that will not kill our park. We want a plan that will offer true resiliency. And that to us means a floodable park, a park that can take salt water and survive just fine, as many parks do. That's really the best practices these days, and get a flood wall along the FDR. And you know, one thing about this project, it's a five-year project, and for at least three of those years, we won't have any flood protection whatsoever. So we're demanding interim flood protection, and the city has not promised that.
Will there be a lawsuit or anything like that?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, that's the next thing.
The next thing is going to be a lawsuit. And mm-hmm. Would that delay the project, do you think? It depends on the judge. Or
well, that's my dream. We would like to get interim flood protection and then get a better plan. And if we can do that using a lawsuit, that's what we're going to try to do.
Pat Arno is founder of East River Park Action. If approved, construction is expected to begin next year. And finally, today, Tiny Mercury, 3,000 miles across, made a big splash as it transited across the face of the much huger sun. It may not have been a solar eclipse, but it has astronomers, professionals, and otherwise amateur astronomers otherwise staring through filters and other contraptions to see the rare event. It began around 7:30 this morning and ended a little after lunch on the corner of St. Mark's Place and Avenue A near Tompkins Square Park. An intrepid young astronomer set up a telescope for all to see.
I'm pointing at Mercury in front of the sun. For the last couple of hours, I think since about 7:30 this morning, it's been traveling left to right in front of the sun, and it's about to finish going past it. Can you see the little black dot?
I can see it.
Well, it's bigger than the moon. It's 3,000 miles wide, but the sun is really humongous. As you see, it is not blocking much of the sunlight.
How are you doing this? What is this, a telescope?
Yeah, it's a telescope, and to save my aching back, I have a 45-degree mirror here, so it's bouncing the light through a right angle. And instead of making it a private affair where I look through the eyepiece and nobody else can see, I'm projecting it onto a piece of white paper so that lots of people can see it simultaneously. There, see, in the last couple of minutes, it's gotten noticeably closer to the edge.
Is this something that happens often or not often?
Every couple of years. There's an article about it in today's New York Times. I'm sure they'll tell you the next time it's going to happen. Unfortunately, look, do you see the sky is sort of whitish? It's a hazy day. You can see the vertical stripe of cloud just to the right of the sun there. So that's why we're just barely seeing that dot. It's not really a clear day.
Are you an amateur astronomer, or is it just as a one-time project? It looks like you had
this. Oh, did you see the bird go by just then? Yeah, I'm an amateur astronomer, but isn't everybody an amateur astronomer?
And that was local Lower East Side resident Mark Moretsky with his telescope watching the transit of Mercury. Transits of Mercury occur 13 or 14 times a century. The next one visible from the U.S. will be in 2049. And that's some of the news for Monday, November 11th, 2019. The news was engineered by Reggie Johnson from the studios of the local, independent, and listener-sponsored WBAI Evening News. I'm Paul DiRienzo.